This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Talk to a few owners of small businesses and any ideas you had of a cushy job with flexible hours and lined pockets evaporates pretty quickly. Megan Humphrey runs several of her own operations, including an organization called HANDS, Helping and Nurturing Diverse Seniors. She says it does allow the business owner the flexibility to make his or her own schedule, but in my case and many others, that is often late at night as well as weekends when friends have finished their 40-hour-a-week job. We are still plugging away as we finish projects, do bookkeeping, take on marketing, etc. I love it, but I want to paint a realistic picture of how much time it takes. Dave Harkless owns Littleton Bike and Fitness in New Hampshire. Among his tips for people hoping to go into business for themselves, don't plan on paying yourself for quite a while. It is really helpful to have a partner or a spouse with a steady income. So why do it? Well, Andy Voda, who created a toy company called Optical Toys, says this: I started and ran my business with the simple philosophy of going for it and then hoping for the best and fearing the worst. I had no desire to build a toy kingdom or toy empire, and I'm quite satisfied with the way things turned out, including the many failures. The endeavor has given me the one thing I desired most in my life, a sense of independence. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to talk about the highs and lows, the possibilities, and the pitfalls of owning your own business. If you are a small business owner, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Tell us the mistakes you made that you would spare someone else from making, and tell us what joy you get out of owning your own company. Again, our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your story on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm joined now by Steve Densham, an advisor with the Vermont Small Business Development Center. That's a state and nationally funded independent organization that gives free mentoring and advising to small businesses. Steve, it's a pleasure to have you here.
It's a great pleasure to be here, Jane. Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by Gwen Piccolo, director of the Women's Small Business Program at Mercy Connections, which is a nonprofit providing educational training for women. Gwen, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Jane.
All right, so I've got this idea. I make these really cool little sculptures, and I'm going to buy a building, and I'm going to sell them out of the building, and I'm going to put my kids through college. Great idea?
Well, Jane, you know, as is so often said, it all depends. And one of the things that happens is that every business venture starts with a good idea. Everybody's had them. Okay? And what the important thing then is to move in to see if there's a business in that idea. And then the step after that is how much of a business is in there. If you want to give up your $90,000 a year W-2 income and you want to make duck decoys in your basement, you better have a large basement, okay? And no disrespect to the wooden decoy makers.
Right. I mean, I guess that's the question. I don't actually make small trinkets. I wish I did. But, you know, is every idea of a business necessarily a business?
I'd say that there is. Where the problem becomes is the scale that it, and what happens is sometimes folks get unrealistic expectations of what their particular idea and their business can do for them, which is why at the basis of our training, we always have clients start out with what we call it the preferred future in both quantitative and qualitative terms. And with a time frame. And then what will your business need to look like to deliver those things for you?
So, Gwen, carry on from there. I mean, if somebody says, I have an idea and I wanted to do these 15 different things, how do you work with somebody to say, all right, let's get a realistic idea of what the business is you want to start, how you're going to run it, and what it's going to do for you?
I think coming down to really what do you need this business to do for you is one of the most important things, like Steve was talking about. I think a lot of times we take whatever can come down the pike, and it's important to remember that we're getting into business because we have a passion in it, but also because we need something out of it. We need something to do with our time. We probably need money out of it. And so we get a lot of people who have a lot of diverse ideas. You know, I want to do this, this, and this, 15 different ideas. So how can you make them into one preferred future? There's a difference between diverse revenue streams and an unfocused business. So finding a way to get those to come in line and work for you.
And both of you work with people to help make that happen so that somebody who has an idea can actually bring it to fruition rather than just either stew on this idea or go forth into the marketplace with no plan and fail.
Right.
How do you do that, Gwen?
Well, we offer classroom-based education programming. So we have a couple of different programs that help women specifically to figure out if they want to go into business, and if they decide, yes, we want to start a business, do comprehensive business planning. So it's a classroom-based, and we help with technical training and building a professional and support network.
Do women face different obstacles than men, whether it's either a confidence or a perception of them in the marketplace?
I think that you just hit the nail on the head in both arenas. I think there are unique circumstances that many women, and of course it's a blanket statement, but typically that women experience differently than men. Women are still the primary caregivers in the family situation. And then, of course, there's the economic statistics that we can come up with, that making, you know, anywhere between 77 cents and 82 cents on the dollar as men, those types of things. And so there are unique circumstances for women. Women also require more relational-based business support. And so finding an opportunity for them to find the support network as well as the professional network can very much help women in starting a business.
Steve Densham with the Vermont Small Business Development Center, what about for you? How do you help people? Because you offer a free mentoring and advising service through the center.
Right. Our main mission is to provide one-on-one advising, coaching, mentoring for small businesses. We do have our two core programs. The first one is the SYOB, the Starting Your Own Business. Very intense. It's about a 4 to 6 hour program that is gets folks to a level of, wow, I didn't realize this was that much work.
So you scare people. Okay.
Of course. Well, you know, one thing, Jane, that's, I mean, really the observation there, is that starting your own business is the scary part. Growing it is the hard part, which brings me to our next core program, which is listening to your business. And this is where we – probably one of the hardest things that a small business owner needs to learn is how to make themselves irrelevant to their own business. And that – from there, we teach you how to work, and we work along with you to learn how to work on your business instead of in it. And there's a big difference there. And, you know, you need to do that if you're going to grow it, or if your revenue stream is totally dependent on you being in the shop or in the building, then you have a do-it-yourself business model, which is fine, but there's an end to that. So we lay out a process for people to follow and a step-by-step plan. And we, one of the metrics and something we're very, very, we feel very strongly about is we want to stay with a business. It's not just, okay, here, we taught you how to do this, go away now. Mm-hmm. It's no, we want to stay with you, grow, because things change.
And interestingly, Steve, you work with quote unquote small businesses in the state, but that's pretty much any business in the state.
Yeah, like I said, there's a number of different definitions of a small business, but when you come around and kind of boil it down, it gets to basically 500 employees or 250 million in sales or less. So I think there's about 9 businesses in the state I could hang the phone up on. I mean, not really, but I am.
We're talking today about owning your own business, how to do it, how it works, and then what it feels like. We're hearing from people around the state and around the region who've started their own businesses and can share their experiences with us. And if you'd like to join them, or if you have a question, maybe you have this secret desire to start a business and don't even really know what the first step is, you can call now. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Peter, who's calling in from Cambridge. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks. Hello, panel. I want to say that I'm going to represent the independent artists and musicians and all the other one-person businesses that there are in Vermont. I've been playing the fiddle, as it were, and violin in a variety of capacities, public and private, and teaching, and adaptability is a huge thing. But I've been doing that since 1984 in Vermont. And I would say that, you know, as Professor Fairbanks, so I have tried every single method of advertising that I could think of, video, cassette, brochures, business cards, internet, Facebook, YouTube, on and on. All those types of tries to get gigs, basically. So the motto of artists is to get the gig, right? So in Vermont, a lot of businesses are hands-on. I have to be at the gig to play the violin at it.
Peter, that sounds like a lot of work. Do you find that you're always working in one capacity or another?
Well, no, I could use a lot more work, but then I'm kind of grateful that I have a lot of time. But at the same time, to get to live in Vermont, lots and lots of people have chosen to be an artist or a farmer. You know, there's lots of art, lots of hours in farming, but there's gratitude and of all nature. And then there's a ton of musicians, though, and artists and jewelry makers and whatnot that they have to be there. But musicians particularly have to kind of be there. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, Peter, I hear what you're saying. Let's turn that to Stephen Gwynn, because, you know, that is an example of a one-man band kind of shop where you can't outsource it, really. I mean, if you are your own product, how do you work that as a business plan so that you're not just pulling your hair out, Gwynn?
I think one of the things that is important is to remember that you did get into the business because you have a passion for it. One of the things that we really focus on is how can you bootstrap into something, into what you want to do? So is there an opportunity perhaps to diversify your revenue streams, right? So maybe our caller, Pete, might consider experimenting with a variety of different ways that that business model might work for him. Maybe it's not always getting the same type of gig, mm-hmm. or, you know, maybe he can adapt it a tiny bit and work with school children or something like that. And so that's one of the re-examining your business model, I think, is really important, especially when it's your business is focused directly on you. How can you also keep that passion going, but also the income coming in?
Steve, with something like that, how do you get yourself tapped into what the rules and regulations are and how to figure out how to pay your taxes? Because you can't just say, I'm doing this job, you give me cash, I pocket the cash, mm-hmm. and we're all good. But how do you know whether you have to call yourself an LLC or what?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And what happens is a lot of folks go ahead and build the structure first and then find that their business, it actually inhibits their business. You know, before you start worrying about whether I'm an LLC or I'm an S corporation or I'm an LC3 or a 501c3, put down, and once again, it goes back to that building what your expectations are. And then seeing which, and if down the road you're talking about bringing in investors there, then you would set your business up differently. It really uses two gentlemen, Teague and Wiggins, put together the principle of backward design years ago. Think ahead and work backwards. And that's the deal. Where do you want to get to? And then build your structure and make it as flexible as you can. Speaking to if Peter's still on the line, one of the things yes, if you're a I've worked with a lot of artists, musicians, who put together some different types of revenue streams. And then also, there are a lot of musicians, there are a lot of artists, but what is your sustainable competitive advantage that you can put into your message? Peter talked about several marketing ideas he's tried. Those are the deliveries.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get that message down, because what is, you know, what you're providing to the market, how do you provide a dramatic difference than the other musician, the other artist, the other restaurant? You know, if that helps at all. And certainly Peter, I don't know where Peter's located, but we do have advisors, six different advisors throughout the state, and he can go onto our website and find some, you know, someone he can sit down with and understands what's going on.
Gwynn Pacallo, just doubling back to this question of how to set yourself up and how to know about taxes, should you have a financial advisor that you've already put on retainer before you even think about opening a business? I mean, do you need that?
Well, that's great if you do have access to that. Most people that we work with don't. And so there are low-cost and free-of-cost services, of course, but when you're starting to look at the technicalities of, for example, the legal structure for your business or the specific accounting things that you'll need in place, going to the private sector is the best fit. You're going to get the best bang for your buck, if you will. And so sometimes it does cost money to start getting into your business, and that can be sometimes the best money you can spend to save you pain down the line. So although you don't need those things in place, unless you have a very clear vision of what you need, especially around funding and the different stakeholders that you'll be bringing into the business, you may be able to find a lot of those services free of cost in your area.
Which will cut down on the amount of capital you need to get your business started.
Not necessarily.
Oh, no.
that it might cut down on, it'll it won't be really cutting down on anything. It'll be expanding your resource network so that you'll be able to know which questions you need to ask and from whom at different points in your business startup.
We're talking today again about starting a small business and running your own business. We're hearing from some of you who are doing just that. Judy's the innkeeper at the Inn on Park Street in Brandon. She writes, I was told years ago by a business school professor, quote, people think that owning your own business means you can work whenever you like. That's the myth. The reality is that you can pick which 14 hours a day you prefer. Oh, so true, Judy says, but it does make all the difference. And Noah says, Stephen Densham was a large part of why my business ever got off the ground. I was terrified to start my own laboratory, but his attitude and support allowed me to open my doors. I'd like to thank him for all the hard work he does supporting Vermont's aspiring entrepreneurs. We did a little Google search on Noah. He runs a dental lab in South Burlington. We are talking with Steve Densham and Gwen Piccolo. And if you have a question about starting your own business, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and today we're talking about how to start and successfully run your own business with Steve Densham, an advisor with the Vermont Small Business Development Center, and Gwen Piccolo with the Women's Small Business Program at Mercy Connections. Let us know how you've done running your own business, why you do it, and what you wish you'd known when you started, or ask a question. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Caroline calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Caroline. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm not sure how much of the previous caller's question might be along the lines of my question, but I have a part-time job, which I love. I manage a farmer's market, but it's always been a struggle to find another part-time job that complements it. So right now I'm researching the viability of a pet-based health business, and I guess I'm wondering how viable it is to start a part-time business. Because I imagine, especially when I'm dealing with pets, there's a lot of legal costs and there's a lot of costs that I don't know how viable it is doing it on a part-time basis.
Oh, Caroline, thanks for the question. Gwen, you want to tackle this one?
Sure. Caroline, I think that sounds really exciting. Starting as a part-time business, I think it's a great option. The IRS has distinctions between hobby businesses, part-time businesses, and full-time businesses. And so it might be that in your startup stage, it might benefit you to start as a part-time business. It's going to be the same amount of work, no matter what, if you're starting up as a 18-hour-a-day business or a one-hour-a-day business. It's going to be the same types of planning and operational pieces that you'll need to put into place. But again, there are systems in place. If you go to your town hall, they'll be able to help you navigating the permits and things that you might need at a local level. And there are the Secretary of State's website has a great checklist for starting a business in Vermont. So there are these resources out there that it might not be as scary as it sounds. And a part-time business, we often encourage our clients to look at different structures to make sure that they're continuing to get a sustainable income from another source when they're in startup.
I imagine that is a difficulty, though, if you have one business that has hours that might be changeable, trying to figure out something else that can sort of complement that first business that you already have might be a difficulty.
Sure. And I think, again, coming back to what do you need out of this business? What do you want this business to do for you? I think keeping that in mind at all points during the startup process is imperative to then shaping out your business model to see what you would want it to look like for you.
Let's go to Leslie in Sunderland. Hi, Leslie. Go ahead.
Hi there. I have my own business, and it's been 4 years now. And one of the things that I thought would be helpful to other people thinking about starting is choosing a name. I make an energy bar called Bat and Kill Brittle, and it's a name that has a you know, certainly a good catchy ring to it. But it doesn't necessarily so much describe the product accurately. And so I have to do some in my marketing to let people know that it's an energy bar and not a candy. And so it just is, and now, you know, it's established and people know it, and so it's not something that I can change at this point in time. But in hindsight, I, you know, choosing something that really is going to, in the name, tell you what it is, I think can help.
Leslie, what would you call it now if you could start it now?
You know, I don't know. I haven't given it that much thought because, you know, like people say, oh, it's a great name, and it is a great name, but, you know, it's a little bit confusing. So I haven't wanted to spend a lot of time on it because it's not going to change. So,
well, thank you for calling and sharing that tip. That is a good one. You know, we've been talking a lot about sort of the bones of your business and the structure and what's behind it. But what's in front of it, you know, the name of your product and how you market it is going to be important. So, Steve, how do you think about that? Because you want something that people are going to remember. But then, you know, Leslie's saying she has to do all of this description now because it doesn't necessarily explain the product. So how do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that come out of it, and it was great, and Leslie's got a great point that she makes. I think the important thing is to realize that branding is doesn't stand – branding is the overall piece, and that the name of your product, how you present it, how you describe it, how you package it, none of those elements stand alone. So the important thing is that they are very synergistic. You don't have to have the perfect, hi, this is a – you know, completely, you know, and put all the things. It goes back to the feature benefit conversation. Don't list all the features of your product if the person doesn't want it yet. So the idea of what Leslie has is has a good product, it's a catchy name. And when they then get into the description, they go, oh, great. It's this, it's that. But I think out of that is it don't have it stand alone. And, I think therein lies, you know, the consistency. The name should allude to what you're about, but, you know, it should have a little bit of you know, a little mystery about it. It should have the consumer not to be shocked, but to be surprised and a discovery piece. So, and it's easier to talk about it than it is to do it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
You need to
make sure everything makes sense, because if you confuse the your market going in, they go, oh, huh, that's not what I thought it was. Then you really want to maybe think about making a transition.
Does this also go to what you were talking about earlier about think to the future? You know, if you have
sure.
a name that's so narrow at the beginning that it's not going to allow you to expand to what you want, or your product might change or the features of it, should you be thinking about that right when you get started, or should you just work on this is what I have now and I want to get it out there to people?
Well, you have, and that's another great question, is that you need to be true to your business model, and the business model will change as you grow. But that idea of what you're doing and what and I use a phrase that sometimes catches people a little bit by surprise is that – and I ask them as – I say not from me speaking as Steve, but as the market, what do you do and why should I care? And it really – that gets to the benefit. I want a healthy snack in Leslie's case. Peter, I want the best fiddle player because he plays this and I do those things, and then build that brand – around those key elements.
You nodding, Gwen. Do you agree with Steve?
Absolutely. I think that it's a delicate balance between over-planning and, oh, well, what are all the possible things I might want to do in my business? And a lot of us get caught up in that. And then actually taking the action and getting it on the market. But then you do need to be prudent about getting your product and your services to the market. And so there is that delicate balance. I think one of the things to keep in mind also is that you can always expand and that there are endless possibilities as long as you put them into their right context. But no decision needs to be permanent. You can always move towards or away from it as you need to. But the planning process, the front end planning process of it, can be very useful in starting to plan out, you know, the future state, being able to grow where you think you might want to grow, and also starting with the pieces that allow you to grow. Growth is one of the most vulnerable times in a small business's trajectory of life, because a lot of times those pieces aren't in place for the growth piece to be able to be accommodated. And so, again, the front end planning process, although planning is innately, you know, wrong, right? Because it's planning and you don't know, you can't predict the future, but you're trying to cut down on all as many unknowns as possible.
Let's go to Jamie calling in from Huntington. Hi, Jamie. You there?
Hello?
Jamie? Hi, go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just want to comment on two things that have kind of been touched upon. One is I started my business 29 years ago before I was married. When I got married, of course, assuming I would stay married, I was able to expand my business that then relied on a double income. And then, given that the divorce rate is 50%, when that happened, I had to increase to working about 100 hours a week in order not to lose my business and make enough money until I could restructure things, which I'm still doing 7 years later because of the expansion, because of the double income.
Mm-hmm.
And no, you know, nobody gets married expecting that that's going to fall apart. So that double income allowed the expansion and then the loss of that income, but wanting to maintain my business and transition slowly so that things worked well and the business maintained itself. It's really, really hard for people to plan that, gosh, this relationship may not last.
Yeah, Jamie, I hear what you're saying. Thanks for sharing your story, because that does bring up, you know, you can sort of plan for things like a flood, you know, not entirely, but you may be able to have different kinds of insurance. You may be able to anticipate an economic downturn. But what about something like that, some interpersonal stuff, relationships that change? We heard right at the beginning from a listener who said it really helps to have a spouse with a steady income so that you can start your business. If suddenly you don't have that spouse or the spouse doesn't have an income, boy, that's a big change. How would you advise trying to work that into a business plan when you don't want to work a divorce into a business plan?
Yeah, Jim, it's difficult, certainly. But the unexpected, I don't care what business you're in and at what stage it's in, something unexpected is going to happen pretty much every day. And one of the great advantages that a small business operator has over a larger business is nimbleness and flexibility. One thing you can do, and yes, if you lose half of your income or if you have a fire in half of your building or something like that, you can make decisions at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and have them in place at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, just as a reference. So that idea that strength, really focus in on and don't so structure your business that when something happens, and it will, the date's just not filled in yet, you're able to react to it. You really want to, a small business person really needs to be on the balls of their business feet. And if I could just make one thing about mm-hmm. the part-time mm-hmm. thing, I think what I share with clients is there's a huge difference between a part-time business and a part-time mentality. And when that is that the most important number you have in business is the number 168. That's how many hours there are in a week. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you have time for everything you give a priority to. And if you have this, you have your business, you've set what you want it to do, and if you're only going to work 1 hour a day, work in that business full time for that hour. And that's – it's different, but big difference between a part-time business and a part-time mentality or commitment to it.
Let's go to Suzanne in the Mad River Valley. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air. Hi, go right ahead.
So I have a – bread bakery that's transitioned from retail to wholesale over the course of the last 5 years. And my question is more along the lines of employees and payroll. When you get to the point as a small business where you are completely maxed out on your own and would like to take on an employee, but there's a threshold where it financially doesn't really make sense to take on payroll for one person. Are there any other options? Are there any other structures? You know, 1099 and subcontracting, I know, is used in construction a lot, but not so much in other businesses. So I'm wondering how you do that, make that jump.
Yeah, Suzanne.
Without having to triple your business as opposed to, say, you know, double or be at the position you're at.
Yeah, interesting question. Gwen, how would you advise Suzanne?
So first off, congratulations, Suzanne. It sounds like things are working. You know, there are different structures. You might consider collaborating. One of the things that we really encourage at the Women Small Business Program is looking at opportunities to kind of re-examine the way that you're looking at, for example, your competition. Instead of looking at them as an us against them, is there an opportunity to collaborate? Are there trade partnerships that you can get into with parts of your supply chain? So those types of questions, the employment questions, are great to ask. They're important. You know, getting into the planning process, you can start to plan that in. But also utilizing the structures in place, like an accountant, like an attorney. That where Suzanne is in her business, I would recommend getting some outside support.
Well, and as we talk about getting support and wrap up this conversation, because there's no way that we're going to be able to tackle everything today or each individual's questions. We got a note from Ellen who says, I'm interested in starting an online and craft fair based business. Are the small business seminars that are being offered a good idea for me, or do I need something more micro based? Any good suggestions on craft based small business resources? And on that note, we might say, you know, how do people who are listening and thinking, okay, I want to take the next step, where do they start? Steve.
Oh, well, the Small Business Development Center, on our website, we have online workshops that are interactive. They're anywhere from 2.5 to 4 hours long, but you can bookmark and go in and come back. And just they just need to contact us, and we can provide them the link and the access code to it. And that gives a broad base. And then the more esoteric questions, we also can find other resources. There may be national organizations that have metrics that can help and stuff like that. Or at SBDC, we consider ourselves, we're a resource and a facilitator. And I refer clients to clients all the time. Well, do you know Jane over at ABC Jewelry at the Underhill Farmers Market? She had this same problem. She'll love to talk to you. And that really helps, because then you know you're not alone in the lifeboat.
And Gwen, just final thoughts on where do you start?
Sure. There are functions of a business that it doesn't matter if you're doing crafts, if you're doing music, or if you're making microscopes that need to be in place. And so since that's the case, finding support is an important part of the planning process. So, for example, at the Women Small Business Program, we have programs that help you to really build your support network with the other people who are starting their businesses, other small business owners, as well as a professional network and technical resources. So there are these resources available. Seek them out, and we'll always refer out, like Steve was saying.
All right, that's Gwen Piccolo. She directs the Women's Small Business Program at Mercy Connections. Steve Densherman is an advisor with the Vermont Small Business Development Center. Thanks very much to both of you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jane.
Thanks for having us.
They're both running workshops. We have more information about them at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Cancer has the power to transform the lives of those who are struck by it and of the people around them. That truism is explored in a new novel by Burlington writer David Huddle. The Fox Chronicle focuses on the matriarch of a large family. I mean, very large, more than 24 kids. And it explores how the family's relationships are tested by her cancer. But cancer has an unexpected side effect on Karen Fox. It makes her seem unusually beautiful. For her insular, plain-looking family, this sudden beautification feels like a betrayal. VPR's Peter Biello spoke with author David Huddle about the Fox Chronicle.
So, pop quiz, can you name all of these children?
I certainly cannot.
I could name a few of them. There are 28 of them, but I know that really only because the proofreader of the galleys made a list of them and their ages and numbered them. And when I saw the number she came up with, it was 28, and I think that's accurate.
Mm-hmm. And not one of these kids takes center stage necessarily. They all sort of exist, and they come almost like superheroes in a way, each of them having their own special talent. Like, I think it was Robert, for example, who was like the family music historian.
Yes, he knows all that stuff. Exactly. And there's one of them, there's an Isabel who's very good at kind of coaching her mother through difficulties. And she's pretty young. I think she's not much more than 10 or so, but they know that she's the right one to go and talk privately with their mother.
And these children talk with their mother quite a bit during this illness, I think, as a way of coping with it. And coping with the changes that are going on with the mother, who you write in the first line of your book, she's becoming pretty. And we are a sort of a simple-looking, homely family.
A homely family.
So give us some perspective on this family. Like, why do they see it as such a betrayal?
I have had a number of friends and family who've died in the past few years. And I actually have seen one of my good friends who, as a result of chemo, became quite an appealing person. I'm not sure that I would call her beautiful or pretty, but somehow the chemo affected her in a way that made her much more appealing, which was startling and a little bit disturbing. So I think that's where it came from.
What do you think it is about this super large family that can tell us something about death and about one person among this group of people who love each other dying?
My mother-in-law died 2 or 3 years ago, and she'd been in the hospital for 40 days, and then finally they sent her home to die. And so my family and my wife's sister's family and boyfriends and husbands, there must have been maybe 20 of us in the house in the presence of that death, and it was quite a moving experience. And some of it, my interest, I'm sure, in this topic was informed by that experience. And even though I think all of us would say that it was a very good thing that we were there in the presence of the matriarchs dying, it really set us off. It was sort of we kind of ricocheted off each other and walked around the house and did things in
ricocheting in an angry way, or
maybe I'm sure that was some of it. But it's almost as if, even though we had known this was coming, it was like an explosion, an emotional explosion that seemed to hit everybody in a different way. And there was this wonderful hospice person who was there who seemed to understand it and who sort of would come and speak to each of us and kind of put us right with it. So there was that. I also wanted as much as possible to make this an unsentimental journey so that the mother is always giving the straight arm to sentimentality. She just won't have it very much, even though it's very clear that she cares deeply about all these kids, her whole family.
You're writing about death, but you're also writing about family in a really interesting way.
Yes.
I can't say I have ever encountered a family of any size that is as intimate as this family is.
Yes.
Have we lost those days when people are so close and intimate, and they're always talking to each other and monitoring each other's feelings, not in a nosy way, but in a concerned way? Is that gone?
Let me say, first of all, that I don't know the answer to that question, but I will say that I've known some large families, and I know my own family, and no family that I know is like the Foxes. They're made up, and that I think that closeness came out of making them talk, their voices. You know, you don't really get a lot about them, or they don't do – they take no significant actions, but they talk a lot, and that has been something that has been my experience. In my current family with my daughters and my wife, we have these conversations that sometimes come close to foreign language because we have so much background that informs every simple sentence. And growing up, it was very much the case with my father and mother and my two brothers that we talked. Man, we really talked. And I don't know that that's closeness. I guess it is close. If you're talking to somebody, you're close enough to talk to them. But sometimes it was conflict and argument.
One of the driving points of tension in this book is the relationship between the mother and the oncologist, Dr. Lawson.
Yes.
Nothing ever comes out that it's sort of untoward, but there's always hints of that below the surface.
Yes.
And since you don't plan your novels, I was wondering how you managed that tension and I don't know, how did you manage that?
One sentence at a time, really.
Yeah.
I did have the oncologist appears really in the first few pages and appears in this way that it's very clear that he has a kind of special feeling for the mother. And I think as I presented, it seems a special feeling that they have every right to be suspicious of. And I do believe that I had in mind that nothing would come of it. But I think the project of the book became, how was I going to manage that? What was I going to do with that since I had set it into motion? So I have them go through quite a number of episodes until it becomes evident that finally is revealed to be a pretty good person.
And this doctor really gets involved with the family. I mean, gets them tickets to a dance show and arranges for a couple of tour buses to to take the mother and the family on sort of her farewell tour.
I think he likes the big family. And I do think that there are people who really like big families. Maybe there are people who didn't come from big families and they probably wouldn't enjoy being in one, but they like being in the company of them.
There's one point in the book, late in the book, where the chapter is entirely made up of just short, unattributed quotes about the mother. And one of the quotes really struck me as very sad. Maybe it's not meant to be sad, but the quote was, one of the children says, "Not a single one of us will ever be able to fit into the real world." Hmm. So do they really not live in the real world? Are they sheltered?
Yes, I guess we'd have to say they are sheltered by being in that kind of community. Family as community. But I also think you have to take them as speaking in character and in situation. So that's the kind of thing you might say, man, because I grew up in this family, I'm never going to fit in the real world. That would be a sentiment you might have when your mother's about to die. Most of them will, I expect.
It's just a feeling they have when they're in the throes of
this pre-grief. It's a way to express grief.
And I wonder what will happen to them. So often in families that have been touched by cancer, mine included, when a sort of central figure like that passes, there's some level of disintegration of the family network.
Yes.
So, I mean, I don't need you to speculate on what will happen to them, but it makes, this is just my reaction as a reader. I was curious about, oh, geez, what's going to happen to these 28 folks?
Yes. Well, they do give you some clues along the way. I think there's a place where they're speaking of one of the girls. Maybe it's Isabel. And they're saying, well, she's, you know, classic folk. She's got this kind of solid build and it's kind of too big forehead and her earlobes are too wide and something like that. And she'll grow up to marry somebody who will be a lot like her. And they will make a family that will be just like our family and so on. I do think that happens, that quite often, say, you end up replicating the family that you came from, either because you really benefited from that family, or in some cases because that family abused you so much that you don't know any other way than to make the same thing all over again.
David Huddle, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. I've enjoyed being here.
David Huddle being interviewed there by VPR's Peter Biello. Huddle's new book is called The Fox Chronicle. He'll be reading at Phoenix Books in Burlington tomorrow night at 7. And now it's time for your messages to Vermont Edition. VPR producer Rick Singeri joins me. Take it away, Rick.
Thanks, Jane. Since the deaths of two toddlers under DCF supervision, the Department of Children and Families has had to face several inquiries into how it investigates child abuse and its policies on working with troubled families.
Last week, we interviewed the new commissioner of the department, Ken Schatz. We talked about the goal of reunifying families when children have been removed. And on that topic, we got this anonymous message from a listener in Barrie City. When cases go on and on for months and no progress is made by parents, why is it we keep reunification on the table, giving them hope? Schatz talked about families who are working hard to address the issues. Well, what about the families who are not working hard and it's clear as day?
Auditor Doug Hoffer is running unopposed for re-election, so rather than force him to debate himself, we talked with him one-on-one on Friday. Sarah wrote, "Thank you for having the auditor on again. I appreciate both his willingness to come on your program and that you have him on somewhat often. This is much there is much to be cynical about today, and government is high on that list, I think this helps.
We had a lot of fun last week talking apples with writer Rowan Jacobson, and we heard from many of you. Here are a couple more of your comments.
Zoe in Burlington wrote, there was an old English, UVM English professor that lived on Spear Street and sold apples. He had write-ups about which famous forefathers liked which kind of apples. As suburban sprawl surrounded his little farm home, you could still see him out picking apples and propping up his old trees and boards.
And Flask wrote, oh my goodness, I heard this show on the road and had to stop to write. The best apples are the ones I can't even find names for that grow next to where the old farmsteads used to be. On the corner near where I live, there's a tall old tree that yields the best, sweetest apple you've ever tasted. But once it ripens, it keeps for only about 20 minutes. On my road, there's a tiny, knobby, bright yellow apple with bright magenta spots that's so sweet your fingers stick to it when you pick it up. Apples are amazing.
Well, we think you are amazing, and we really appreciate when you write in and participate in the program each day. There are a few ways you can give us your feedback.
Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net or connect with us on social media.
We're on Facebook and Twitter at Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Rico.
Oh, welcome, Jane.
All right, that's it for today. Tomorrow, lovers of classical music are celebrating two big milestones in Vermont. The Vermont Symphony Orchestra is celebrating its 80th season, and VPR's own Walter Parker marks his 30th anniversary on the air this week. Tomorrow on the show, we will look at how Vermont's classical music scene has grown and matured over the decades. So tune in for that conversation at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.